1,000 workers, 4,500 factories out of 7,000. And we're talking about workers getting a dollar or two an hour. Los Angeles is no better. The southern end of the city houses America's and perhaps the world's largest concentration of garment sweatshops, staffed by some 160,000 workers, many of them illegal and thus powerless immigrants. There, a U.S. Department of Labor survey found the overall level of compliance with the minimum wage, overtime, and child labor requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act is 33%. In other words, 67% of the garment industry workplaces did not comply with the law. Such systemic unlawfulness is not unique to the garment industry, however. Corporate illegalities are rife throughout the economy. Many major corporations engage in unlawful behavior, and some are habitual offenders with records that would be the envy of even the most prolific human criminals. Take, for example, General Electric, the world's largest corporation and one of the most highly respected. What follows is a record, compiled by Multinational Monitor, of some of the company's major legal breaches between 1990 and 2001. March 23, 1990, Shepherdsville, Kentucky. GE and others ordered to clean up PCB contamination of soil and water. March 27, 1990, Wilmington, North Carolina. GE fined $20,000 for discrimination against employees who reported safety violations. May 11, 1990, Fort Edward, Hudson Falls, New York. GE ordered to clean up PCB contamination of Hudson River. July 27, 1990, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. GE fined $30 million for defrauding government in defense contracts. October 11, 1990, Waterford, New York. GE fined $176,000 for pollution at Silicone Products Plant. May 20, 1991, Washington, D.C. GE ordered to pay $1 million in damages over improperly tested aircraft parts for Air Force and Navy. February 27, 1992, Allentown, Pennsylvania. GE ordered to pay $80 million in damages for design flaws in nuclear plants. March 4, 1992, Orange County, California. GE fined $11,000 for violating worker safety rules on handling PCBs. March 13, 1992, Wilmington, North Carolina. GE fined $20,000 for safety violations at nuclear fuel plant. May 22, 1992, Illinois. GE ordered to pay $65 million in damages for design flaws in nuclear plants. July 22, 1992, Washington, D.C. GE fined $70 million for money laundering and fraud related to the illegal sale of fighter jets to Israel. September 13, 1992, Chicago, Illinois. GE ordered to pay $1.8 million in damages for airplane crash. October 12, 1992, Nashville, Tennessee. GE ordered to pay $165,000 in damages for deceptive advertising of light bulbs. October 27, 1992, Washington, D.C. GE ordered to pay $576,215 in damages for overcharging on defense contracts. May 12, 1992, Washington, D.C. GE ordered to pay $13.4 million in damages to whistleblower on illegal sale of fighter jets to Israel. March 2, 1993, Riverside, California. GE and others ordered to pay $96 million in damages for contamination from dumping of industrial chemicals. March 11, 1993, Grove City, Pennsylvania. GE and others ordered to clean up mining site. July 18, 1993. Hudson Falls, New York. GE ordered to clean up PCB contamination of Hudson River. September 16, 1993, New York. GE ordered to compensate commercial fishermen $7 million for PCB contamination of the Hudson River. October 11, 1993, San Francisco, California. GE ordered to offer $3.25 million in rebates to consumers after deceptive light bulb advertising. February 2, 1994, Perry, Ohio. GE settles with utility companies on defective Perry nuclear plant. March 14, 1994, Fort Edward, New York. GE ordered to clean up contamination of sediment in the Hudson River. September 14, 1994, Washington, D.C. GE fined $20 million for overcharges on defense contracts. September 2, 1995, Waterford, New York. GE fined $1.5 million for air pollution and contamination of Hudson River. September 15, 1995, Brandon, Florida. GE fined $137,000 for groundwater contamination. September 9, 1996, Waterford, New York. GE fined $60,000 for Clean Air Act violations. October 7, 1996, Hendersonville, North Carolina. GE ordered to clean up contaminated soil and groundwater. October 8, 1996, Cook County, Illinois. GE ordered to pay $15 million as settlement for airline crash in Sioux City, Iowa. February 22, 1997, Somersworth, New Hampshire. GE and others ordered to clean up contamination of groundwater and public water supply. February 1998, Waterford, New York. GE fined $234,000 for pollution violations. April 20, 1998, Waterford, New York. GE fined $204,000 for pollution violations. October 1998, United Kingdom. GE ordered to pay £2 billion for asbestos cleanup and related pollution claims. October 26, 1998, Puerto Rico. GE and others ordered to clean up contamination of drinking water supply. November 5, 1998, South Whitehall, Pennsylvania. GE and others ordered to clean up contamination. January 24, 1999, Chicago, Illinois. GE ordered to reimburse consumers $147 million for unfair debt collection practices. August 19, 1999, Piscataway, New Jersey. GE and others ordered to clean up contaminated groundwater. September 2, 1999, Malvern, Pennsylvania. GE and others ordered to clean up groundwater contamination. September 17, 1999, Moreau, New York. GE ordered to build drinking water system after PCB contamination of water supply. October 9, 1999, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. GE ordered to clean up PCB pollution in Housatonic River. October 18, 2000, New York, New York. GE and others ordered to clean up contamination of soil. January 2001, New York. GE and others ordered to refund $4 million in overcharges on mortgage insurance. February 4, 2001, New York State. State Supreme Court rules that GE deceptively misled consumers into purchasing new dishwashers after recall, even though it sent commercial customers a replacement part. The corporation's unique structure is largely to blame for the fact that illegalities are endemic in the corporate world. By design, The corporate form generally protects the human beings who own and run corporations from legal liability, leaving the corporation, a person with a psychopathic contempt for legal constraints, the main target of criminal prosecution. Shareholders cannot be held liable for the crimes committed by corporations because of limited liability, the sole purpose of which is to shield them from legal responsibility for corporations' actions. Directors are traditionally protected by the fact that they have no direct involvement with decisions that may lead to a corporation's committing a crime. Executives are protected by the law's unwillingness to find them liable for their company's illegal actions unless they can be proven to have been directing minds behind those actions. Such proof is difficult, if not impossible, to produce in most cases, because corporate decisions normally result from numerous and diffuse individuals' inputs, and because courts tend to attribute conduct to the corporate person rather than to the actual people who run the corporations. The corporation itself is thus the most viable target for prosecution in most cases, and because it has no soul to be damned and no body to be kicked, as Edward Thurlow, Lord Chancellor of England, observed in the 18th century, punishing the corporation often has little impact. Like the psychopath it resembles, the corporation feels no moral obligation to obey the law. Only people have moral obligations, as Frank Easterbrook, a judge and legal commentator, and law professor Daniel Fishel observe in an article they co-authored. Corporations can no more be said to have moral obligations than does a building, an organization chart, or a contract. For a corporation, compliance with law, like everything else, is a matter of costs and benefits. Again and again in America, we have the problem that whether corporations obey the law or not is a matter of whether it's cost-effective, says Robert Monks. If the chance of getting caught and the penalty are less than it costs to comply, our people think of it as just being a business decision. Executives, when deciding whether to comply with or break a law, behave rationally and make cost-effective decisions, says Monks, which means they ask, what's the penalty? What's the probability of being caught? How much does that add up to? And how much does it cost to comply, and which is bigger? Law professor Bruce Welling states the logic this way. The practical business view is that a fine is an additional cost of doing business. A prohibited activity is not inhibited by the threat of a fine, so long as the anticipated profits from the activity outweigh the amount of the fine multiplied by the probability of being apprehended and convicted. Considering the amount of the average fine, deterrence is improbable in most cases. The argument is even more obvious regarding prevention of recidivism. The corporation, once convicted and fined, will simply have learned how to cover its tracks better. The irony in all of this is that the corporation's mandate to pursue its own self-interest, itself a product of the law, actually propels corporations to break the law. No corporation is exempt from this built-in logic. Not even those that claim they are socially responsible, as a second look at British Petroleum reveals. On August 16, 2002, Don Shugak, a British Petroleum technician, was making his rounds at the company's Prudhoe Bay oil field in Alaska, checking wells for leaks and other problems. One of his assignments was to reactivate a well that had been shut down for repairs. BP engineers knew that the well still had problems and would operate at unusually high pressures once reactivated, but they gave Shugak the green light anyway. Shugak opened the valve to reactivate the well and then left the site. Several hours later, he returned to bleed off pressure from the wellhead, a routine procedure. Though he remembers opening the wellhouse door on his return visit, his recollection of what happened after that is vague. It was hard to breathe, he recalls. His ears were ringing and his legs were paralyzed. He clung to the side of his truck, which was parked nearby, and made his way to the other side of it to shield himself from the heat of the massive explosion that had just occurred. I started crawling 2 and 3 inches at a time with my elbows, he recalls. I tried rolling because my elbows were so tired, but my legs kept getting tangled up. Fortunately, a coworker had heard the explosion and seen the now 40-foot flames from a distance. He rushed to the scene and called for help. I didn't even feel like I was hurt, said Shugak. I didn't feel anything. I just knew nothing was working the way it was supposed to. Everybody was talking in hushed tones. Shugak woke up in a Seattle hospital burn unit 2 weeks later, with burns covering 15% of his body, a broken leg, and badly damaged knees and vertebrae. He was lucky to have survived. Many of Shugak's co-workers blame the accident on BP's persistent failure to comply with maintenance and safety regulations, about which they had complained well before the accident happened. In a 1999 letter to BP's chief executive, John Brown, operators allege that the company was not in compliance with statutory and regulatory requirements. They cited a leaky valve as a factor in a 1998 spill of 1,200 gallons of oil and thousands of cubic feet of gas. The incident was ranked by the company at the most serious level in terms of potential employee deaths and environmental damage. All we needed was a spark, and that plant would have burned to the ground, one operator said at the time. A report following the incident called for a proactive maintenance program to check all similar valves and replace them if necessary, echoing a recommendation made 5 years earlier by the state regulatory agency responsible for oversight of the valves. Neither recommendation was implemented, according to BP operators, and the valves continued to be prone to leaks. Even 3 years later, in spring 2001, state inspectors found that 1/3, 9 of 30, of the pads at one of BP's drilling platforms were defective and did not comply with regulatory standards. On July 16, 2001, a month before Shugak's accident, a group of BP operators had contacted BP's probation officer, Mary Barnes, and alleged that the company was in breach of a 1999 probation order. The order had been issued by an Alaskan court, which had convicted BP of one felony count of knowingly failing to immediately report the release into the environment of a hazardous substance. BP had wrongfully acquiesced over a 2-year period to illegal discharges of hazardous substances by one of its contractors. The company was fined the maximum penalty of $500,000 and placed on organizational probation. The probation conditions included an undertaking by the company to comply with best environmental practices in order to effectively protect workers, the public, and the environment, and to comply with all statutory and regulatory requirements. In their letter to the company's probation officer, the BP operators alleged that BP operations are undeniably not in compliance with government regulations, citing numerous examples of regulatory breaches, many relating to the safety valves. For BP, however, it appears that regulatory standards are just another factor to be considered in its cost-benefit analysis. Like other large oil companies, BP allocates operating budgets to oil fields on a cost-per-barrel basis. As the production in a field declines, so too does that field's operating budget. From the perspective of profitability, that makes eminent sense, as companies want to maintain their profit levels even as fields become less productive. From a safety and maintenance perspective, however, according to BP operator William Burkett in testimony before a Senate committee on Alaskan oil, this creates a situation that quickly impacts managers' ability to maintain the equipment in the field. The primary reason for that is the equipment used to produce oil prior to decline is, for the most part, still in operation, In fact, often more equipment is added and more wells drilled as the field matures to slow the production decline. So, what happens is there is as much or more equipment in service with an increasing need for maintenance as it ages, while the budget to operate and maintain the equipment decreases with a production decline. In 1988, production at the Prudhoe fields began to decline, and the dangerous logic of cost-per-barrel analysis went into play. London knew what to do to keep the dollars coming, says Burkitt. Cut. Cut the budget, cut the employee numbers, cut wages, cut spare parts, cut maintenance, cut supervision, just cut. In 1992, BP began a downsizing program that would eventually leave the company with one-third fewer employees at its Prudhoe operations. The reason, says Burkitt, that there are now too few technicians to monitor and maintain the aging infrastructure and ensure that it complies with regulatory standards. In the wake of Don Shugak's accident, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the regulatory agency responsible for overseeing BP's operations, heard testimony on whether new regulations were needed to protect workers and the environment from poorly maintained wells. Not surprisingly, BP opposed the introduction of new regulations. But even if new regulations were enacted, would they make a difference? Burkitt thinks not. All the regulations in the world do little good if there's no enforcement, he says. Enforcement remains a serious problem in Alaska's oil fields, as a recent article in the Wall Street Journal observed. Alaska's legislature, eager to please the industry, has gutted the state agencies responsible for regulating oil field safety. The paucity of resources makes it hard for Alaska's oil safety inspectors to do their job. Stretched by the state's vast terrain and its 3,500 wells, the five inspectors say they schedule their field tests with the oil companies to ensure that inspectors don't travel hundreds of miles only to discover that necessary personnel or equipment aren't around. Lost is the element of surprise that regulators in some other major oil-producing states swear by as the crucial component in keeping oil companies honest. Instead, Alaska's safety regulators operate on trust. Throughout the economy today, the regulatory system often fails because of lax regulations and ineffective enforcement. Until that changes, we shall continue to suffer unnecessary disasters and harm to people, communities, and the environment. That is the price we all pay for the proclivity of corporations to profit by harming others. Chapter 4. Democracy Limited. As institutional psychopaths, corporations are wont to remove obstacles that get into their way. Regulations that limit their freedom to exploit people and the natural environment are such obstacles, and corporations have fought with considerable success over the last 20 years to remove them. Through lobbying, political contributions, and sophisticated public relations campaigns, they and their leaders have turned the political system and much public opinion against regulation. The law's ability to protect people and the environment from corporate harm has suffered as a result. Business opposition to regulation did not begin in the current era, however. It can be traced back to the origins of the regulatory state itself. Surely, the most bizarre moment in its history was when a group of leading bankers and corporate executives conspired to overthrow President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who they believed had gone too far with his regulatory ambitions, and replace him with a fascist dictator. The story reads like a pulp fiction thriller, but it really happened. Shortly after becoming President of the United States in the spring of 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt created the New Deal, a sweeping and unprecedented set of regulatory laws and agencies that aimed to strengthen government's control of big corporations and banks. The New Deal reflected Roosevelt's conviction that the Great Depression would end only once the market's invisible hand was replaced by the very visible and benevolent hand of government. In that spirit, Roosevelt signed into law, among other things, new rights and protections for workers, debt relief for farmers, and fairness and transparency guarantees for investors. He later described his creation as follows. The word deal implied that the government itself was going to use affirmative action to bring about its avowed objectives, rather than stand by and hope that general economic laws would attain them. The word new implied that a new order of things designed to benefit the great mass of our farmers, workers, and businessmen would replace the old order of special privilege in a nation which was completely and thoroughly disgusted with the existing dispensation. We were not to be content with merely hoping for constitutional ideals. We were to use the instrumentalities and powers of government actively to fight for them. Because the American system visualized protection of the individual against the misuse of private economic power, the New Deal would insist on curbing such power. Inevitably, the New Deal did just that. It curbed corporations' freedoms and powers. Though many business leaders agreed with Roosevelt that the New Deal was necessary to save capitalism from itself, especially at a time of rising labor militancy and a collapsing economy, others were enraged and believed that Roosevelt's plan would undermine American capitalism, which is why a group of them plotted to overthrow his government. On August 22, 1934, a little more than a year into Roosevelt's presidency, and 3 days after Adolf Hitler had officially become Führer of Germany, Smedley Darlington Butler, a former U.S. Marines general and one of the nation's most honored and decorated military men, entered the lobby of the Bellevue Hotel in Philadelphia. A man named Gerald McGuire, a World War I veteran who sold bonds for a living, was waiting to meet him. After a brief exchange of pleasantries, McGuire told Butler he had been sent by a group of businessmen to ask the general to raise an army, seize the White House, and install himself as fascist dictator of the United States. Many business leaders at the time found fascism attractive, especially when they compared it to the class hatred preached from the White House, as Herbert Hoover characterized Roosevelt's New Deal. Benito Mussolini and Hitler had slashed the public debt, curbed inflation, driven down wages, and taken control of the trade unions in Italy and Germany, respectively. Roosevelt, on the other hand, had turned traitor to his class, they believed, and was now bent on destroying American capitalism. In its July 1934 issue, Fortune magazine extolled the virtues of fascism and the economic miracles wrought by Mussolini. Laird Goldsborough, the man who produced the issue, wrote, "The good journalist must recognize in fascism certain ancient virtues of the race, whether or not they happen to be momentarily fashionable in his own country." Indeed, at the time, some major American corporations were reaping substantial profits by working for Adolf Hitler. Adam Opel, AG, a German automobile maker owned and controlled by General Motors, which at the time was controlled by the DuPont family, was, with the help of GM executives, transformed in 1937 into an armaments concern. It manufactured trucks for the German army, including 3-ton Opel Blitz trucks, a crucial part of the Blitzkrieg attacks on Poland, France, and the Soviet Union. It also built aircraft components, including engines for the Luftwaffe's Junker Wunderbomber. A recent GM television commercial boasts of the role of GM trucks in building roads and bridges to support the Allied campaigns during World War II. "Some people say we were paving the road to victory," the ad states, but neglects to mention that the company helped build trucks for the enemy's armies as well. IBM, a company where, if your customer needs help, you jump, according to Irving Lodosky-Berger, Vice President, Technology and Strategy, jumped When Hitler sought its technical assistance in running the Nazi extermination and slave labor programs. IBM provided the Nazis with Hollerith tabulation machines, early ancestors of computers, that used punch cards to do their calculations. Edwin Black, author of IBM and the Holocaust, says, "The head office in New York had a complete understanding of everything that was going on in the Third Reich with its machines, that their machines were in concentration camps generally, and they knew that Jews were being exterminated. IBM technicians serviced the machines, IBM engineers trained their users, and IBM supplied punch cards for the machines, according to Black, at least until 1941, when the United States declared war on Germany." IBM's motivation for working with the Nazis, says Black, was never about Nazism. It was always about profit, which is consistent with the corporation's amoral nature. Corporations have no capacity to value political systems, fascist or democratic, for reasons of principle or ideology. The only legitimate question for a corporation is whether a political system serves or impedes its self-interested purposes. According to Peter Drucker, who says he discussed it more than once with old Mr. Watson, the head of IBM at the time, Thomas Watson had reservations about working with the Nazis. Not because he thought it was immoral, says Drucker, but because Watson, with a very keen sense of public relations, thought it was risky from a business perspective. In a similar spirit, Alfred Sloan Jr., chairman of General Motors in 1939, seemed morally unconcerned about his company's work for the Nazis. The German subsidiaries were highly profitable, he noted in defense of GM's investments in Germany, and Germany's internal political affairs should not be considered the business of the management of General Motors. Though the assistance provided to the Nazis by U.S. corporations may seem shocking in retrospect, it should not be forgotten that many U.S. corporations today regularly do business with totalitarian and authoritarian regimes, again, because it is profitable to do so. Looking back on the 1930s, a time when some top American corporations unabashedly worked with fascist dictators and many business people believed that the federal government was threatening the capitalist system, one can at least comprehend why a cabal of leading businessmen would hatch a plot to turn the country into a fascist dictatorship. Removing democracy likely seemed a defensible business plan from their perspective, because democracy threatened to undermine the corporation's mission. And Smedley Butler was the obvious person for the job of removing it. Or at least that is what McGuire and his backers thought. Butler had been a lifelong Republican and was a charismatic public speaker. A celebrated military hero, one of only four men to be decorated with the coveted Congressional Medal of Honor twice, the general had spent most of his military career protecting American business interests throughout Asia and Central America. He was also adored by veterans, for whom he had fought for better treatment and more generous benefits from government. Butler seemed ideally positioned to raise an army of veterans and lead them on a campaign to seize the White House. McGuire and Butler had already met several times before the Bellevue Hotel meeting. A year earlier, McGuire had invited himself to Butler's Philadelphia home, claiming to be a representative of concerned veterans, and asked the general to deliver a speech at an upcoming American Legion convention. The speech, a copy of which McGuire had with him, was designed to rally the veterans against Roosevelt's decision to abandon the gold standard, which, once done, would cost the banks dearly. Butler, confused about why veterans should be concerned with the gold standard, had refused McGuire's request. A few months later, in September 1933, McGuire had found Butler again, this time in New Jersey, where the general was delivering a speech to a Legion branch. The two men had met in Butler's hotel room, where McGuire had once again pleaded with the general to deliver the gold standard speech at the Chicago convention. According to Butler, McGuire scattered a mass of $1,000 bills on the bed and invited him to use them to finance his trip to Chicago. "You put that money away before somebody walks in here and sees that money around," Butler recalled telling McGuire, "because I do not want to be tied up with it at all." When the two men met at the Bellevue Hotel several weeks later, Butler had already acquired the names and affiliations of the men McGuire purported to represent, mainly from McGuire himself. There was, Butler later stated, Grayson Murphy, head of a leading Wall Street brokerage firm and a director of Morgan Guaranty Trust, as well as of Anaconda Copper, Goodyear Tire, and Bethlehem Steel. Robert Clark, a wealthy banker whom Butler had actually met after demanding McGuire produce some of his backers, and who had told Butler that he was prepared to spend half of his $30 million fortune to protect the other half from Roosevelt, was another alleged backer of the plot, as was John Davis, the unsuccessful Democratic candidate for president in the 1924 election, and later an attorney at J.P. Morgan & Company. The meeting at the Bellevue Hotel took place in the closed-down hotel cafe at a table tucked away in a remote corner. McGuire began by telling Butler that he had spent the past 6 months in Europe. Butler recalled the rest of the conversation as follows. He said, "I went abroad to study the part that the veteran plays in the various setups of the governments that they have abroad. I went to Italy for 2 or 3 months and studied the position that the veterans of Italy occupy and the fascist setup of government, and I discovered that they are the background of Mussolini. I then went to Germany to see what Hitler was doing, and his whole strength lies in organizations of soldiers, too. Then I went to France, and I found just exactly the organization we are going to have. It is an organization of super soldiers. He gave me the French name for it, but I do not recall what it is. I never could have pronounced it anyhow. But I do know that it is a super organization of members of all the other soldiers' organizations of France, composed of non-commissioned officers and officers. He told me that they had about 500,000, and that each one was a leader of 10 others, so that it gave them 5 million votes. And he said, now that is our idea here in America, to get up an organization of that kind. McGuire told Butler that his backer's plan was to create an American version of the Croix de Feu, the French soldiers' organization whose name Butler was unable to recall, and install the general at the head of it. With a powerful army behind him, the plotters anticipated Butler could demand that Roosevelt make him a Secretary of General Affairs, a new position where he would serve as a kind of assistant president. From there, Butler could assume real power over the nation, and the president would become a mere figurehead, on the contrived pretext that Roosevelt's health was failing. If Roosevelt refused to cooperate with the scheme, according to McGuire, Butler's army would overthrow him. Journalist Paul Comely French, who also spoke with McGuire, corroborated Butler's story. During the course of the conversation, he continually discussed the need of a man on a white horse, as he called it, a dictator who would come galloping in on his white horse. He said that was the only way, either through the threat of armed force or the delegation of power and the use of a group of organized veterans to save the capitalist system. He warmed up considerably after we got underway, and he said, we might go along with Roosevelt and then do with him what Mussolini did with the King of Italy. It fits in with what he told the general, that we would have a Secretary of General Affairs, and if Roosevelt played ball, swell, and if he did not, they would push him out. The money was there, McGuire boasted to Butler during their meeting, to raise and equip a veterans' army, $3 million in place and $300 million available if needed. His backers were already on the move, he said, putting together a front organization that would provide secret financial and practical support for the plot. The formation of the American Liberty League, an organization to combat radicalism, to teach the necessity of respect for the rights of person and property, and generally to foster free private enterprise, was announced 3 weeks later. The League's treasurer, Grayson Murphy, was McGuire's boss. Robert Clark was a major financial contributor, and men from J.P. Morgan and DuPont were the League's executives. John Davis was a member of the National Executive Committee. Financial backers included some of corporate America's major concerns, the Pitcairn family, Andrew Mellon Associates, Rockefeller Associates, E.F. Hutton Associates, William Knudsen of General Motors, and the V. Pugh family. McGuire and the plotters had made a fatal mistake in their choice of a leader, however. With incredible ineptitude, states Jules Archer in The Plot to Seize the White House, they had selected the wrong man. The plot and the men behind it represented everything Smedley Butler now despised. Over the years, his youthful passion for battles abroad had given way to an equally fierce desire to fight hypocrisy at home. He had come to believe that war was a product of corporate greed, that his men had fought for no higher ideal than profit. On August 21, 1931, a full 2 years before McGuire first approached him, Butler had stunned an audience at an American Legion convention in Connecticut when he had said, "I spent 33 years being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1916. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenue in. I helped in the rape of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. I had a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, promotions. I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate a racket in three cities. The Marines operated on three continents." Butler was not about to add the United States to the list of countries where he had used military force to defend U.S. corporate interests from populist threats. On November 20, 1934, he revealed the plot to the House Un-American Activities Committee in a secret executive session in New York City. By that time, the general had collected as much information as he could about the plot and had made sure his story was corroborated by the work of Paul French, who also testified before the committee. The committee vindicated Butler's story in all of its essential elements and submitted its findings to the House of Representatives on February 13, 1935. In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient. This committee received evidence from Major General Smedley D. Butler, retired, twice decorated by the Congress of the United States. He testified before the committee as to conversations with one Gerald C. McGuire, in which the latter is alleged to have suggested the formation of a fascist army under the leadership of General Butler. McGuire denied these allegations under oath, but your committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, with the exception of the direct statement suggesting the creation of the organization. This, however, was corroborated in the correspondence of McGuire with his principal, Robert Sterling Clark, of New York City, while McGuire was abroad studying the various forms of veterans' organizations of fascist character. With Butler having refused to cooperate with McGuire and his backers, and the committee's unwavering vindication of the general's story, the plot to seize the White House quickly unraveled. There was no doubt that General Butler was telling the truth, committee co-chair John McCormick later recalled in a 1971 interview with Archer. The plotters definitely hated the New Deal because it was for the people, not for the moneyed interests, and they were willing to spend a lot of their money to dump Mr. Roosevelt out of the White House, McCormick stated. Those fellows got desperate and decided to look into European methods with the idea of introducing them into America. They sent McGuire to Europe to study the fascist organizations. How close was America's brush with fascism, Archer wanted to know. Well, said McCormick, if General Butler had not been the patriot he was, and if they had been able to maintain secrecy, the plot certainly might very well have succeeded, having in mind the conditions existing at that time. If the plotters had got rid of Roosevelt, there's no telling what might have taken place. They wouldn't have told the people what they were doing, of course. They were going to make it all sound constitutional, of course, with a high-sounding name for the dictator and a plan to make it all sound like a good American program. A well-organized minority can always outmaneuver an unorganized majority, as Adolf Hitler did. Today, 70 years after the failed coup, a well-organized minority again threatens democracy. Corporate America's long and patient campaign to gain control of government over the last few decades, much quieter and ultimately more effective than the plotters' clumsy attempts, is now succeeding. Without bloodshed, armies, or fascist strongmen, and using dollars rather than bullets, corporations are now poised to win what the plotters so desperately wanted, freedom from democratic control. On July 24, 2002, 9 desperate coal miners waited to be rescued from a watery hell 240 feet below a Pennsylvania cow pasture. Miraculously, they had escaped a torrent of water that had flooded their mine after they had mistakenly drilled into an adjacent mine shaft that was filled with water. The miners were finally rescued after spending 78 hours in a cramped air pocket. President Bush proclaimed when he flew into town 1 week later that the miners' courage and perseverance reflected that of all Americans in the aftermath of September 11, 2001.
It was their determination to stick together and to comfort each other, he said, that really defines this kind of a new spirit that's prevalent in our country. That when one of us suffers, all of us suffer. That in order to succeed, we've got to be united. That by working together, we can achieve big objectives and big goals.
It was, ironically as it turns out, similar sentiments that had originally animated Roosevelt's belief in the virtues of government regulation, including the regulation of coal mine safety. In 1941, with Roosevelt in the White House, Congress substantially strengthened the regulatory regime for protecting coal miners' safety by granting to the Federal Bureau of Mines the authority to enter and inspect mines for possible safety hazards. Though the Bureau was almost 30 years old, its jurisdiction had previously been limited to collecting information and conducting research. Now, for the first time, it could actually enforce legislated safety standards. Further improvements would soon follow. In 1952, Congress enacted the Federal Coal Mine Safety Act, which gave the Bureau new powers to issue and enforce violation notices, to close mines where inspectors found imminent dangers, and to require that mines be inspected on an annual basis. The act was strengthened in the late 1960s and then replaced in 1977 with a new act, the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act, that consolidated protections for all types of mining and created a new enforcement agency, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, to take over from the Bureau of Mines. Annual mining fatalities dropped from 272 to 86 during the first decade of the new agency's operations. More recently, the Bush administration introduced measures that could have had the effect of rolling back protection of coal miners' safety. In his first budget, George W. Bush sought cuts to staffing levels at the MSHA, but these were defeated by the then-Democratic majority in Congress. Then, in his 2003 budget, Bush sought a $4.7 million cut in the agency's coal enforcement program, to be realized through reduction of 65 full-time employees, the termination of a chest X-ray program to detect black lung disease in miners, and a reduction in inspection outreach activities, technical investigations, compliance follow-up, education, and training and technical assistance. With the new Congress and its Republican majority, these proposals seemed likely to be enacted. But after intense lobbying by the United Mine Workers of America, UMWA, the Senate Appropriations Committee voted to restore the $4.7 million to the MSHA budget. Bush's budget for 2004 now proposes a $6.3 million cut to enforcement of coal mine safety standards. Even if no cuts end up being made, however, the MSHA, due to its earlier cuts, is unable to complete statutorily mandated inspections, its inspector general said in January 2002. According to United Mine Workers Chief Joseph Main, the statutory requirement that a mine be inspected 4 times each year is seldom met, and inspections when they do occur tend to be rushed and ineffective. The Kew Creek flood, it turns out, may have been caused by the miners' reliance on old, inaccurate maps. The maps showed that the abandoned flooded mine that the miners drilled into, causing their own tunnel to flood, was located 300 feet away from its actual location. Floods similar to the one at Kew Creek had occurred at 2 other mines operated by Black Wolf Mining Company, the operator of Kew Creek Mining, and a subsidiary of PBS Coals, within the 2 years preceding the Kew Creek incident. It is reasonable to presume that an appropriately staffed and well-functioning agency might have ensured that the Kew Creek miners had accurate maps and thus prevented their horrible ordeal. Funding cuts to the agencies responsible for enforcing regulatory laws are increasingly common across the regulatory system, not just in relation to mining. Their effect, if not always their intention, is to deregulate corporate behavior. Though legal standards are left in place, the gutting of enforcement mechanisms ensures that they are substantially weakened and sometimes entirely ineffective. Cuts to the agencies that regulate Alaska's oil fields and to the Department of Labor's budget, which have compromised effective enforcement of the Fair Labor Standards Act, are examples discussed earlier. Cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and the Securities and Exchange Commission have also recently been blamed for harm caused by inadequate oversight of corporate activities within those agencies' jurisdictions. A second kind of deregulation involves the actual repeal of regulations. This phenomenon, too, is pervasive throughout the regulatory system. Laws designed to protect the public interest from corporate misdeeds are being scaled back and are sometimes disappearing altogether. There is no better illustration of the dangers of this trend than the Enron debacle. When the lights first went out in California on December 7th, 2000, an event that would occur almost 40 more times over the next 6 months and wreak havoc on the state and its citizens, no one suspected that Enron was largely to blame. Overregulation was blamed by many for the suddenly short supply of electricity, and deregulation was proposed as the solution.
If there's any environmental regulations that's preventing California from having a 100% max output at their plants, as I understand there may be, stated President-elect George Bush in January 2001, then we need to relax those regulations.
Republican Senator Phil Gramm, another Texan, blamed
those who valued environmental extremism and interstate protectionism more than common sense and market freedom for the disaster.
What eventually came to light, however, was that Enron's highly successful and very expensive campaign to eliminate government oversight of its operations had been a major factor in the electricity system's failure. Stripped down to its essentials, Enron's is the story of a corporation that used political influence to remove government restrictions on its operations and then exploited its resulting freedom to engage in dubious, though highly profitable, practices. Through the 1990s, the company and its officials, chiefly former CEO Kenneth Lay, dumped huge amounts of money into the political process to help transform an unremarkable pipeline company into a powerhouse energy trader.